From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Throughout history, Juneteenth has been known by many names. Jubilee Day, Freedom Day, Liberation Day, Emancipation Day, and today, a national holiday.
The first African-American Vice President, Kamala Harris, announcing that President Biden signed legislation to make Juneteenth a federal holiday to mark the day in 1865 when enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, learned of their freedom more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. We'll speak to the writer and poet Clint Smith about Juneteenth and his new book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America.
My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved, right? So when my three-year-old son sits on my grandfather's lap, I imagine my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded how this history that we tell ourselves was so long ago was in fact not that long ago at all.
Plus, we look at another June 19th, 1838, when Jesuit priests who ran what's now Georgetown University sold 272 enslaved men, women, and children to pay off the school's debts. The Jesuits recently pledged $100 million to help descendants of the enslaved.
Our ancestors have waited patiently through centuries for us to come to the table of acknowledgement. I am Melisande, short Cologne. Here I am.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden has signed legislation creating a new federal holiday for Juneteenth to mark the end of slavery in the United States. The celebration marks June 19th, the day in 1865 that enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, learned of the Emancipation Proclamation, signed by Abraham Lincoln more than 2 years before, and that the Civil War had ended. A White House signing ceremony Thursday was kicked off by Kamala Harris, the first African-American vice president.
We are gathered here in a house built by enslaved people. We are footsteps away from where President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And we are here to witness President Joe Biden establish Juneteenth as a national holiday.
After headlines, we'll discuss the history of Juneteenth and the legacy of slavery with the writer and poet Clint Smith. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell signaled Thursday Republicans will use the filibuster to block the For the People Act, a sweeping bill to restore protections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which was gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. McConnell's pledge came as Senate Republicans rejected a compromise offer of a watered-down voting bill offered by West Virginia Democrat Senator Manchin. Manchin and Arizona's Senator Kyrsten Sinema have refused calls from within their party to eliminate the filibuster in order to pass voting rights legislation, an infrastructure bill to combat catastrophic climate change, and other priorities of the Biden administration. The House of Representatives had voted to repeal sweeping war powers granted to the president in 2002 ahead of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. The bill to repeal the AUMF, or Authorization for Use of Military Force, was sponsored by California Democratic Congressmember Barbara Lee. On September 14, 2001, days after al-Qaeda attacks on the U.S., Lee spoke on the House floor opposing military action against Afghanistan. She was the lone voice of dissent that day and went on to oppose the Iraq invasion in 2003. Congresswoman Lee spoke again from the House floor Thursday, just ahead of the 268-161 vote in favor of repealing the AUMF.
Now, 18 years ago, in front of the infamous Mission Accomplished banner backdrop, former President Bush told the nation that the major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In 2011, President Obama brought our combat troops home, and yet this authority remains on the books, vulnerable to misuse because Congress has not acted to remove it. The Bush administration, yes, misled the American people by saying there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that Iraq posed an imminent threat, and by drawing a false connection between the tragic events of 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. Those lies and misinformation had deadly consequences. The mistakes continue to haunt us today.
The bill now heads to the Senate, where Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has promised to oppose a repeal of the AOMF. Brazil reported another 2,300 COVID-19 deaths Thursday, bringing its official death toll during the pandemic to nearly 500,000. This comes as a Brazilian Senate inquiry into President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the pandemic shows his government failed to respond to 53 out of 81 communications sent by Pfizer offering to negotiate the sale of COVID vaccines to Brazil, leading to a disastrous delay in mass vaccinations. In the United Kingdom, coronavirus infections have surged to a four-month high, even though 63% of people have received at least one dose of a vaccine, a higher rate than in the United States. British officials say the Delta coronavirus variant is spreading rapidly, especially among unvaccinated youth. This week, Prime Minister Boris Johnson extended public health restrictions for another month. Israeli warplanes bombed several sites in the Gaza Strip overnight in the second breach of the ceasefire that ended Israel's 11-day bombardment of the besieged Palestinian territory in May. Israel's military said the strikes targeted Hamas in retaliation for incendiary balloons launched from Gaza. There were no immediate reports of casualties. Israel's assault last month killed at least 253 Palestinians, including 66 children, and wounded more than 1,900. People. At least 12 people in Israel, including two children, were killed by rockets fired from Gaza. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said Israel's actions may have constituted war crimes. In the West Bank, hundreds of Palestinians rallied Thursday at the funeral of Ahmed Shamsa, a 16-year-old shot in the head by Israeli forces at a protest Wednesday in the town of Beita. He was killed less than a week after Israeli soldiers shot dead 15-year-old Mohammed Hamayel at another protest against the expansion of an illegal Israeli settlement in Beita. Local Palestinians say Israeli settlers have repeatedly raided their town to chop down olive trees and vandalize their property with impunity. In Iran, voters are at the polls today to elect a new president. Ibrahim Raisi, the conservative head of the judiciary and close ally of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is widely expected to win. Raisi is under U.S. sanctions for his alleged involvement in the execution of political prisoners decades ago. The new president will succeed Hassan Rouhani at a crucial time as talks continue to relaunch the Iran nuclear deal, which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from in 2008 under President Trump, reimposing sweeping sanctions in Iran. In a rare acknowledgment, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said Wednesday his nation faces widespread food shortages due to international sanctions, the COVID-19 pandemic, and crop failures caused by last summer's typhoons. The World Food Program says about 40% of North Korea's population is undernourished. The Intercept reports a top official in the outgoing Bolivian government plotted to deploy hundreds of mercenaries from a U.S. military base near Miami to overturn the results of Bolivia's election in October 2020. Though the coup plot was never carried out, documents and recorded phone calls reveal the former Bolivian Minister of Defense, Luis Fernando Lopez, discussed the plan with Joe Pereira, a former civilian administrator with the U.S. Army. Pereira, who has boasted of links to U.S. special forces, promised Lopez he could mobilize thousands of foreign mercenaries to join elite Bolivian military units, renegade police squadrons, and vigilante mobs to prevent Bolivia's Movement to Socialism Party from retaking power.
I can get up to 10,000 men with no problem. I don't think we need 10,000. all the special forces. I can also bring about 350 what we call LEPs, law enforcement professionals, to guide the police.
Socialist candidate Luis Arce went on to win the Bolivian presidency in the first round of voting last October, putting an end to the far-right government, which ousted President Evo Morales in a U.S.-backed coup in November of 2019. In a 7-2 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act for a third time after a challenge by Texas and 17 other Republican-led states. The group argued the individual mandate was unconstitutional after Congress did away with the penalty for not having coverage as part of the 2017 tax cuts for the wealthy. Around 31 million Americans benefit from President Obama's signature 2010 legislation. The court did not rule on the constitutionality of the individual mandate, but found the plaintiffs could not prove their harm by the ACA in its current iteration. In a separate case, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Nestle and Cargill Thursday after six former child slave laborers accused the massive corporations of complicity in their trafficking and enslavement. The men were trafficked from Mali as children and forced to work on cocoa plantations in the Ivory Coast, which supplied to U.S. companies. Neil Katyal, former acting solicitor general under President Obama, who represented Nestle and Cargill, argued they should not be held responsible because they're corporations, not individuals. In a blow for LGBTQ rights, the Supreme Court also ruled Thursday a Catholic agency in Philadelphia that screens foster parents does not have to abide by city law and consider potential LGBTQ foster parents. In other Supreme Court news, advocates for abolishing the death penalty are calling out the hypocrisy of the Biden administration after the Justice Department requested the High Court reinstate the execution of Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. This despite Biden's pledge on the campaign trail to work towards eliminating federal capital punishment. Meanwhile, in South Carolina, two executions have been put on hold until the prisoners can be offered a choice of being killed by electrocution or firing squad, as required by South Carolina's recently passed capital punishment law. As a record, heat wave continues to scorch the western United States, with some 40 million people facing over 100-degree weather. Wildfires continue to rage in the Southwest. In Arizona, the massive Telegraph Fire merged with the Mescal Fire, as has burned over 200,000 acres. This comes as the Arizona legislature approved a new funding package that will pay prisoners just $1.50 an hour to fight fires. To see our interviews with California prisoner firefighters, go to democracynow.org. And in Hong Kong, police have arrested five editors and executives of the Apple Daily newspaper, accusing them of colluding with foreign powers in violation of a sweeping national security law. The Apple Daily, which has been one of the most outspoken defenders of Hong Kong protests against Chinese one-party rule, vowed to continue its reporting. But media analysts warn other news outlets will now think twice before crossing Chinese authorities. This is Hong Kong professor Rose Wee Chu.
Of course, it will have definite impact on the press freedom here in Hong Kong, because, first of all, it will create a chilling effect, although the government denies that. But think about that. If you are a journalist working for news media, you will be scared.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When we come back, we look at the new federal holiday, Juneteenth, with the author Clint Smith, author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Stay with us.
Say, come unto me, I am the way. Keep your hand on the plow, oh Lord. When my way get dark, darkest night. Know the Lord will be my light. Keep your hand on the plow. Oh, Lord. Stay on the knee, keep your hand on the plow. Oh Lord, when I get to heaven, go sing and shout. Be nobody that'll put me out. Keep your
hands on the plow by Mahalia Jackson. The spiritual forms the basis for the civil rights song Eyes on the Prize. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, President Biden signed legislation to create a new federal holiday to commemorate Juneteenth, which marks the end of slavery in the United States. The Juneteenth celebration dates back to the last days of the Civil War, when Union soldiers landed in Galveston, Texas, on June 19, 1865, with news that the war had ended, and enslaved people learned they were freed 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Juneteenth is the first new federal holiday since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day was created nearly 40 years ago. President Biden spoke at the ceremony at the White House Thursday.
Juneteenth marks both the long, hard night of slavery and subjugation and a promise of a brighter morning to come. This is a day of profound, in my view, profound weight and profound power. A day in which we remember the moral stain, the terrible toll that slavery took on the country and continues to take. What I've long called America's original sin.
The bill to make Juneteenth a federal holiday was passed by a unanimous vote in the Senate. But in the House, 14 Republicans, all white men, voted against the holiday. At Thursday's White House ceremony, Vice President Kamala Harris spoke about how enslaved people in Texas were held for over 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation.
For more than 2 years, the enslaved people of Texas were kept in servitude. For more than 2 years, they were intentionally kept from their freedom for more than 2 years. And then on that summer day, 156 years ago, the enslaved people of Texas learned the news. They learned that they were free, and they claimed their freedom. It was indeed an important day.
To talk more about Juneteenth and the legacy of slavery, we're joined by the writer and poet Clint Smith. He's author of the new book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. He's also a staff writer at The Atlantic. Clint Smith, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So one of the chapters in your book is Galveston Island. And that is where Juneteenth comes from. Can you tell us the story in full of Juneteenth and your feelings today? This is the first day the federal holiday is being celebrated because June 19th actually falls on a Saturday.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I went to Galveston, Texas. I've been writing this book for 4 years, and I went 2 years ago, and it was marking the 40th anniversary of when Texas had made Juneteenth a state holiday, and it was the Al Edwards prayer breakfast. The late Al Edwards Sr. is the state legislator, a black state legislator, who made possible and advocated for the legislation that turned Juneteenth into a holiday, a state holiday in Texas. And so I went in part because I wanted to spend time with people who were the actual descendants of those who had been freed by General Gordon Granger's General Order Number 3. And it was a really remarkable moment because I was in this place, on this island, on this land, with people for whom Juneteenth was not an abstraction. It was not a performance. It was not merely a symbol. It was part of their tradition. It was part of their lineage. It was an heirloom that had been passed down that had made their lives possible. And so I think I gained a more intimate sense of what that holiday meant, and to sort of broaden out more generally, you spoke to how it was more than 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, and it was an additional 2 months after General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, effectively ending the Civil War. So it wasn't only 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, it was an additional 2 months after the Civil War was effectively over. And so for me, when I think of Juneteenth, part of what I think about is both the both-handedness of it, that it is this moment in which we mourn the fact that freedom was kept from hundreds of thousands of enslaved people for years and for months after it had been attained by them. And then at the same time, celebrating the end of one of the most egregious things that this country has ever done. And I think what we're experiencing right now is a sort of marathon of cognitive dissonance in the way that is reflective of the Black experience as a whole, because we are in a moment where we have the first new federal holiday in over 40 years, and a moment that is important to celebrate the Juneteenth and to celebrate the end of slavery, and to have it recognized as a national holiday. And at the same time that is happening, we have a state-sanctioned effort across state legislatures across the country that is attempting to prevent teachers from teaching the very thing that helps young people understand the context from which Juneteenth emerges. And so I think that we recognize that as a symbol, Juneteenth is not that it matters, that it is important, but it is clearly not enough. And I think what the fact that Juneteenth has happened is reflective of a shift in our public consciousness, but also of the work that Black Texans and Black people across this country have done for decades to make this moment possible.
And can you explain more what happened in Galveston in 1865, and even, as you point out, what the Emancipation Proclamation actually did 2.5 years before?
Right. So the Emancipation Proclamation is often a widely misunderstood document. So it did not sort of wholesale free the enslaved people throughout the Union. It did not free enslaved people in the Union. In fact, there were several border states that were part of the Union that continued to keep their enslaved laborers, states like Kentucky, states like Delaware, states like Missouri. And what it did was it was a military edict that was attempting to free enslaved people in Confederate territory. But the only way that edict would be enforced is if Union soldiers went and took that territory. And so part of what many enslavers realized, right, and realized correctly, was that Texas would be one of the last frontiers that Union soldiers would be able to come in and enforce the Emancipation Proclamation, if they ever made it there in the first place, because this was 2 years prior to the end of the Civil War. And so you had enslavers from Virginia and from North Carolina and from all of these states in the Upper South who brought their enslaved laborers and relocated to Texas in ways that increased the population of enslaved people in Texas by the tens of thousands. And so when Gordon Granger comes to Texas, he is making clear and letting people know that the Emancipation Proclamation had been enacted in ways that, because of the topography of Texas and because of how spread out and rural and far apart from different ecosystems of information many people were, a lot of enslaved people didn't know that the Emancipation Proclamation had happened. And some didn't even know that General Lee had surrendered at Appomattox 2 months prior. And so part of what this is doing is making clear to the 250,000 enslaved people in Texas that they had actually been granted freedom 2.5 years prior, and that the war that this was all fought over had ended 2 months before.
At Thursday's presidential signing ceremony, Joe Biden got down on his knee to greet Opal Lee, the 94-year-old activist known as the grandmother of Juneteenth. This is Biden speaking about Lee.
As a child growing up in Texas, she and her family would celebrate Juneteenth. And Juneteenth, 1939, when she was 12 years old, a white mob torched her family home. But such hate never stopped her any more than to stop the vast majority of you I'm looking at from this podium. Over the course of decades, she's made it her mission to see that this day came. It was almost a singular mission. She's walked for miles and miles, literally and figuratively, to bring attention to Juneteenth, to make this day possible.
And this is Opal Lee speaking at Harvard's School of Public Health earlier this week.
I don't want people to think Juneteenth is just one day. There is too much educational components. We have too much to do. I even advocate that we do Juneteenth, that we celebrate freedom from the 19th of June to the 4th of July. Because we weren't free on the 4th of July, 1776. That would be celebrating freedom. You understand? If we were able to do that.
And that is Opal Lee, considered the grandmother of Juneteenth. And Clint, one of the things you do in your book is you introduce us to grassroots activists. This doesn't come from the top. This comes from years of organizing, as you point out, in Galveston itself and with people like, not that there's anyone like Opal Lee.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Part of what this book is doing, it is an attempt to uplift the stories of people who don't often get the attention that they deserve in how they shape the historical record. So that means the public historians who work at these historical sites and plantations. That means the museum curators. That means the activists and the organizers, people like Take 'Em Down NOLA in New Orleans, who pushed the city council and the mayor to make possible the fact that in 2017, these statues would come down, several Confederate statues in my hometown in New Orleans. And part of when I think about someone like Ms. Opal Lee, part of what I think about is our proximity to this period of history, right? Slavery existed for 250 years in this country and has only not existed for 150. And, you know, the way that I was taught about slavery growing up in elementary school, we were made to feel as if it was something that happened in the Jurassic Age, that it was the Flintstones, the dinosaurs, and slavery, almost as if they all happened at the same time. But the woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture alongside the Obama family in 2016 was the daughter of an enslaved person, not the granddaughter or the great-granddaughter or the great-great-granddaughter. The daughter of an enslaved person is who opened this museum, the Smithsonian, in 2016. And so there's clearly, for so many people, there are people who are alive today who were raised by, who knew, who were in community with, who loved. People who were born into intergenerational chattel bondage. And so this history that we tell ourselves was a long time ago wasn't, in fact, that long ago at all. And part of what so many activists and grassroots public historians and organizers across this country recognize is that if we don't fully understand and account for this history that actually wasn't that long ago, that in the scope of human history was only just yesterday, then we won't fully understand how our contemporary landscape of inequality today. We won't understand how slavery shaped the political, economic, and social infrastructure of this country. And when you have a more acute understanding of how slavery shaped the infrastructure of this country, then you're able to more effectively look around you and see how the reason one community looks one way and another community looks another way is not because of the people in those communities, but is it because of what has been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. And I think that that is central to the sort of public pedagogy that so many of these activists and organizers who have been attempting to make Juneteenth a holiday and bring attention to it as an entry point to think more wholly and honestly about the legacy of slavery have been doing.
During an interview on CNN, Democratic Congress member Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called out the 14 Republican Congress members, all white men, who voted against making Juneteenth a federal holiday.
This is pretty consistent with, I think, the Republican base, and it's whether it's trying to fight against teaching basic history around racism and the role of racism in U.S. history to, you know, there's a direct through line from that to denying Juneteenth, the day that is widely recognized and celebrated as the symbolic kind of day that to represent the end of slavery in the United States.
If you could respond to that, Clint Smith, and also the fact that on the same day yesterday, the Senate minority leader said they would not be supporting the For the People Act, the Voting Rights Act.
Absolutely. I think very clearly the critical race theory, the idea of it is being used as a boogeyman, and it is being misrepresented and distorted by people who don't even know what critical race theory is, right? So we should be clear that the thing that people are calling critical race theory is just, that is the language that they are using to talk about the idea of teaching any sort of history that rejects the idea that America is a singularly exceptional place. And that we should not account for the history of harm that has been enacted to create opportunities and intergenerational wealth for millions of people that has come at the direct expense of millions and millions of other people across generations. And so what part of what is happening in these state legislatures across the country and with regard to the effort to push back against teaching of history, 1619 Project, critical race theory and the like, is a recognition that we have developed in this country a more sophisticated understanding, a more sophisticated framework, a more sophisticated public lexicon with which to understand how slavery, how racism was not just an interpersonal phenomenon. It was a historic one. It was a structural one. It was a systemic one. And I'm very much sympathetic. I know there's some sentiment out there that people are saying, well, you know, we didn't ask for Juneteenth to become a holiday. We want voting rights. We want police reform. We want abolition. We want, and I'm 100% understand that. I also think that we should not undervalue what it means for Juneteenth to become a holiday, in part because then we are not valuing the work that Black activists have done over the course of decades to get there. And because while symbols are not necessarily material change, they are not irrelevant. So I think all the time about having grown up in New Orleans, and to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard. To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway. That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy. That the street my parents live on today is named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people. And the thing is that names and symbols and holidays like aren't just names and symbols and symbolism. What they are reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that societies carry. And those narratives shape public policy, and public policy that shapes the material conditions of people's lives, which is not to say that taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee or making Juneteenth a holiday is going to erase the racial wealth gap. Of course not. But what it is part of an ecosystem of narratives and stories and ideas that can help us recalibrate our understanding of why certain communities look the way that they do and what needs to be done and invested in those communities to create a new set of opportunities. So we should recognize and celebrate that Juneteenth is a holiday. And we should also recognize that that is not enough. It is not nearly enough. And that it is one part of a much longer struggle and a much larger struggle to make sure that we are creating a more equitable and just world.
And that was pointed out earlier this week by the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's been denied tenure at University of North Carolina all in this time, though there's a mass effort to turn that around. She spoke to MSNBC about the mounting attacks against discussing systemic racism in history classes at schools. Over 20 states now having banned the teaching of critical race theory. She produced the 1619 Project with the New York Times, an interactive project that reexamines the legacy of slavery, the target of this right-wing backlash last year after the Trump administration threatened to pull federal funding from schools that use the 1619 Project in their curriculum. This is Nicole Hannah-Jones.
I think we're in actually a very dangerous period right now. When we look at what these laws are doing, you know, a lot of people have kind of scoffed at them. When you read the language of them, they appear very silly. But when you think about what this is actually trying to do, we know that it is narrative that allows us to enact really dangerous policies. It is narrative that allows citizens to kind of accept these erosions of civil rights. So it's not incidental that the same states that are introducing these anti-critical race theory, anti-1619 project laws are also introducing voter suppression laws. These things are going hand in hand.
So that's Nicole Hannah-Jones, Clint Smith.
Yeah, and she's absolutely right. I mean, I think that these two things are deeply entangled in one another. I think that there is a state-sanctioned effort to prevent people from understanding our history, because if you prevent young people and people more generally from understanding the history of this country and how racism has, again, animated so much of our public policy decisions, then when certain voting rights or certain voting legislation is enacted to prevent people from having the right to the ballot box or having access to the ballot box in the way that they should, then you can ground it in a sort of ahistoricism that pretends that it is not something that is very intentionally attempting to keep Black people from exercising their right to the franchise. And because there is a recognition that the more people understand the history that has shaped what our political infrastructure looks like, from the Electoral College to gerrymandering, the more you realize how entangled that is in, again, in the history of slavery. And so all of these things, as Nicole said, absolutely go hand in hand and should be understood as such.
Amazingly, New York Daily News reported, watchdog group wants teachers to wear body cams to assure they don't teach critical race theory in Nevada District. But I'm going to leave that one there. And I want you to talk more about your book, How the Word is Passed, a reckoning with the history of slavery across America. Can you talk about the journey you took? You were just mentioning where you grew up in Louisiana, the map of the streets of Louisiana, and why you feel it is so critical not only to look at the South, but your chapter on New York is something that people will be, many will be, shocked by. The level of, when people talk about the South and slavery, that New York, of course, had enslaved people.
It did. It was really important for me to include a chapter on New York City and a place in the North more broadly, in part because, you know, while the majority of places I visit are in the South, because the South is where slavery was saturated and where it was most intimately tied to the social and economic infrastructure of that society, it most certainly also existed in the North. What a lot of people don't know is that New York City, for an extended period of time, was the second largest slave port in the country after Charleston, South Carolina. That in 1860, on the brink of the Civil War, when South Carolina was about to secede from the Union after the election of Abraham Lincoln, that New York City's mayor, Fernando Wood, proposed that New York City should also secede from the Union alongside the southern states because New York's financial, political, and political infrastructure were so deeply entangled and tied to the slaveocracy of the South. Also that the Statue of Liberty was originally conceived by Edouard de Laboulaye, a French abolitionist who conceived of the idea of the Statue of Liberty and giving it to the United States as a gift, that it was originally conceived as an idea to celebrate the end of the Civil War and to celebrate abolition. But over time, that meaning has been, even through the conception of the statue, right? The original conception of the statue actually had Lady Liberty breaking shackles, like a pair of broken shackles on her wrist to symbolize the end of slavery. And over time, it became very clear that that would not have the sort of wide stream or wide mainstream support of people across the country. Obviously, this having been just not too long after the end of the Civil War, so there were still a lot of fresh wounds. And so they shifted the meaning of the statue to be more about a sort of inclusivity, more about the American experience, the American project, the American promise, the promise of democracy, and sort of obfuscated the original meaning to the point where even the design change. And so they replaced the shackles with a tablet and the torch and then put the shackles very subtly sort of underneath her robe. And you can but the only way you can see them, these broken chains, these broken links, are from a helicopter or from an airplane. And in many ways, I think that that is a microcosm for how we hide the story of slavery across this country, that these chain links are hidden out of sight, out of view of most people. From on under the robe of Lady Liberty, and how the story of slavery across this country is very, as we see now, very intentionally trying to be hidden and kept from so many people, so that we have a fundamentally inconsistent understanding of the way that slavery shaped our contemporary society today.
In your book, you write that by the early 19th century, the New York financial industry became even more deeply entrenched in chattel slavery. Money from New York bankers went on to finance every facet of the slave trade. Explain.
It did. So the banks in New York City were where the planters and the enslavers in the South got their capital. It is how they used the bodies of enslaved people as collateral for loans that they would take out and with insurance companies. I mean, and so it is very clear not only that New York City had enslaved people itself, right, for an extended period of time, as did places in New England, Connecticut, Rhode Island, but that it is the financial and economic infrastructure of New York City and the people who created mass amounts of wealth in that city that allowed slavery to continue to evolve and prosper. And that really made it so that there, I think we tend to have this sort of bifurcated view and overly simplistic view of like, oh, the people in the North were the good guys and people in the South were the bad guys. But there were a lot of people in the North. And as I talked about in New York City, who were deeply committed to the perpetuation and existence of slavery in the South because it was beneficial for them economically. It was beneficial for them politically. It was beneficial for them socially. And it was in line with how they understood the role of enslaved people and black people in this country. It is not, they might not want to have wanted to have owned enslaved people themselves, but they most certainly did not believe in an abolition, or they most certainly did not think that they wanted something to prevent the massive influx of capital that they were receiving from continuing to flow into their hands.
Clint, before we end, you are an author, you're a writer, you're a teacher, and you are a poet. Can you share a poem with us?
I'd be happy to. And so when you're a poet writing nonfiction, that very much animates the way that I approach the text. And so this is this is an adaptation or an excerpt from the end of one of my chapters that originally began as a poem that I wrote when I was trying to think about some of these issues that I brought up. Growing up, the iconography of the Confederacy was an ever-present fixture of my daily life. Every day on the way to school, I passed a statue of P.G.T. Beauregard riding on horseback, his Confederate uniform slung over his shoulder, and his military cap pulled far down over his eyes. As a child, I did not know who P.G.T. Beauregard was. I did not know he was the man who ordered the first attack that opened the Civil War. I did not know he was one of the architects who designed the Confederate battle flag. I did not know he led an army predicated on maintaining the institution of slavery. What I knew is that he looked like so many of the other statues that ornamented the edges of this city. These copper garlands of a past that saw truth as something that should be buried underground and silenced by the soil. After the war, the sons and daughters of the Confederacy reshaped the contours of treason into something they could name as honorable. We called it the Lost Cause, and it crept its way into textbooks that attempted to cover up a crime that was still unfolding. They told us that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man, guilty of nothing but fighting for the state and the people that he loved, that the Southern flag was about heritage and remembering those slain fighting to preserve their way of life. But see, the thing about the Lost Cause is that it's only lost if you're not actually looking. The thing about heritage is that it's a word that also means I'm ignoring what we did to you. I was taught the Civil War wasn't about slavery, but I was never taught how the declarations of Confederate secession had the promise of human bondage carved into its stone. I was taught the war was about economics, but I was never taught that in 1860, the 4 million enslaved black people were worth more than every bank, factory, and railroad combined. I was taught that the Civil War was about states' rights, but I was never taught how the Fugitive Slave Act could care less about a border and spell Georgia and Massachusetts the exact same way. It's easy to look at a flag and call it heritage when you don't see the black bodies buried behind it. It's easy to look at a statue and call it history when you ignore the laws written in its wake. I come from a city abounding with statues of white men on pedestals and black children playing beneath them, where we played trumpets and trombones to drown out the Dixie song that still whistled in the wind. In New Orleans, there are over 100 schools, roads, and buildings named for Confederates and slaveholders. Every day, black children walk into buildings named after people who never wanted them to be there. Every time I would return home, I would drive on streets named for those who would have wanted me in chains. Go straight for 2 miles on Robert E. Lee, take a left on Jefferson Davis, make the first right on Claiborne. Translation, go straight for 2 miles on the general who slaughtered hundreds of black soldiers who were trying to surrender. Take a left on the president of the Confederacy who made the torture of black bodies the cornerstone of his new nation. Make the first right on the man who permitted the heads of rebelling slaves to be put on stakes and spread across the city in order to prevent the others from getting any ideas. What name is there for this sort of violence? What do you call it when the road you walk on is named for those who imagined you under a noose? What do you call it when the roof over your head is named after people who would have wanted the bricks to crush you?
Clint Smith, author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. You should get it today on this first federal observance of Juneteenth. Thanks so much, Clint.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at another June 19th 1838, when Jesuit priests who ran what is now Georgetown University sold 272 enslaved people to pay off the school's debts. We'll speak to one descendant. Stay with us.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here is a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run. Brother like me begun to be another one. Public enemy serving time. They drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the strength of situations unreal, I got a raw deal. So I'm looking for the steel. Word them up. I'm looking for
Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos by Public Enemy. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at another June 19th, 1838, when Jesuit priests who ran what's now Georgetown University sold 272 enslaved men, women, and children to pay off the school's debts. In 2016, Georgetown University announced it would give preferential admissions treatment to descendants of the Africans and enslaved and sold. In 2017, the New York Times published the only known photograph of Frank Campbell, one of the enslaved people sold by the Maryland Jesuits in 1838. In March, the Jesuits pledged $100 million to atone for their participation in slavery in a deal with a small representative group of descendants, the Catholic Church, and corporate partners. A wider group of descendants opposed the deal, saying it was done in private and doesn't go far enough to repair the harms done. In a minute, we'll be joined by Melisande Short-Colomb, one of the first two Georgetown University students to benefit from legacy admission for direct descendants. First, though, this is a trailer of her one-woman play, Here I Am.
Oh, an American family story.
I feel like my whole life and all of the lives that have come before me are balled up inside of me. The New York Times broke a story in April 2016 revealing that the Jesuits had sold 272 enslaved persons in 1838. To raise funds to keep Georgetown University going. A few months later, I discovered that I descended from two families in the sale, the Queens and the Mahonies. By September 2017, I had entered Georgetown College as an undergraduate student at the age of 63. Here I am, paying homage to 11 generations of the women who have come into me and who are part of me. I am here to tell their story, handed down over more than 300 years. Our ancestors have waited patiently through centuries for us to come to the table of acknowledgement. I am Melisande Short-Colomb. Here I am. Here we are.
The trailer for the one-woman play, Here I Am, by Melisande Short-Colomb, who joins us now. One of the first two students to benefit from legacy admission for direct descendants of the enslaved by the Jesuits at Georgetown University, where she's also a community engagement associate and serves on the board of advisors for the Georgetown Memory Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Melisande. It's such an honor to have you with us. Your thoughts today on this first federal holiday of Juneteenth. And if you can talk about that other June 19th, 1838, and what happened.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me here. Juneteenth, 2021. Here we are, acknowledging
injustices of the past in the present for the future. Yes, it did take enslaved people 2.5 years in Texas to learn that they had been freed. But it's taken us 156 years as Americans to acknowledge that event. So we are the turners of the wheels of progress and change. June 19th, 1838, 183 years ago, my family, two sides of my family, my young great-great-great-grandparents, met on a boat on their way to Louisiana and started a family that results in me and many of my cousins in Louisiana. We were part of the human trafficking trade in the United States of America, not the theoretical middle passage, which was very true and brought people to more people to the Caribbean and South America than to the United States of America. Yes, I am a Black woman in 2021 who the institution of slavery was built in the wombs of my grandmothers because every child that they brought into this world, in this life, in this place, from 1677 until 1865 were slaves at birth. What kind of people do that? Which brings us to the Jesuits, to the founders of the United States of America, to 1868, to 1865, to 1921 to 2021. So ours as Americans is an uninterrupted line of inheritance that many of us refuse to believe that we are descendants of. Black people are not just the descendants of enslavement here in America. We are all the descendants of enslaved here in America. And that is, if you got here in 1570, 1619, 1677, or somebody threw you over the fence yesterday. We are here in this place that is 245 years old, plus the colonial period. This belongs to all of us.
Melisande, if you can talk about how Georgetown was saved, prevented from going into bankruptcy by the sale of nearly 300 enslaved people. Of course, I hate to use the word saved. In fact, that was a damning of the university.
Well, the university, the Jesuits owned property in human beings and in land. In all of their dealings and sales and building of economic wealth here in America, they always had a choice. We can sell people, we can rent out people, or we can sell land. And they always chose to sell the people and not the land. The Jesuits still own all the land that they have always owned in Maryland and in the District of Columbia, the Catholic Church. It's not just the Jesuits. The Archdiocese of Baltimore got money from this sale, the Catholic Church, up until 1865 in the United States of America, were slave-owning Confederates.
So I want to go for a moment to Reverend Tim Kesicki, the president of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States, speaking at Georgetown University's Liturgy of Remembrance, Contrition, and Hope.
Today, the Society of Jesus, who helped to establish Georgetown University and whose leaders enslaved and mercilessly sold your ancestors, stands before you to say that we have greatly sinned. We pray with you today because we have greatly sinned and because we are profoundly sorry.
So, Melisande Short-Colomb, if you can talk about what this $100 million deal is, where does this money go? And how did you determine that you were one of the descendants? And then the larger group of people who are understanding where they come from.
I cannot actually speak to the details of this agreement between the Jesuits and this group of descendants. I am not part of that group, nor was I privy to those conversations, decisions, and agreements that were met. I'm outside of that. I appreciate the effort, the five-year effort that went into creating this concept, because what they've done is make it a GoFundMe. So we have to raise money. The Jesuits have to raise money to correct the economic disparities of the past. This is within the framework of the Catholic Church and not the wider descendant community. Is it a good thing? Yes, it is. I just don't know and cannot opine other than to say, good, do your work.
And then there was in 2019, the students of Georgetown voting to create a reparations fund for the descendants of enslaved people sold by the Jesuits, adding a fee of $27.20 to tuition. What happened after this?
Nothing. It was taken over by the administration. And this was the first time in the United States of America that a voting body voted to go into their own pockets, $27.20. The opposition to that was it should be charitable, which is the position that the administration has taken over and made it a GoFundMe. So what the students said was, we're going to go into our pockets as undergraduate students in perpetuity to create an endowment, a student endowment to engage as Georgetown undergraduate students with the larger descendant community.
Finally, so, your play, Here I Am, your one-woman play, what is your message?
I think here we all are. And my hope with Here I Am was that we have something, we have created something that can instigate and initiate conversations in the larger context of who we are.
And those conversations will definitely continue here. I want to thank you so much, Melisande Short-Colomb, one of the first two Georgetown University students to benefit from the legacy admissions for direct descendants enslaved by the Jesuits. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.